It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says phrases like boys will be boys and man up can create a narrow idea of what it means to be a man for young kids. A Wisconsin author shares his own experience and expert advice for raising boys to be good adults. First, a Wisconsin law regulating how people can get criminal convictions removed from their records could make it harder for them to get jobs. Right now, having a felony or misdemeanor conviction on a record could prevent a number of people from being employed, which could have a long-term impact on Wisconsin's economy. A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Institute looks at the impact this law has on people and how amending the law could help grow the state's workforce. Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us how this process called expungement works now in Wisconsin, Joe.
Yeah, so currently a person can request expungement at a sentencing hearing. So that's the only time when it can be requested. What expungement is it seals a criminal record from public access. So it prevents the public from seeing that and can help a person move on and reduce barriers for them moving forward.
What are some of the ways that expungement is limited here in Wisconsin compared to other states, some of our neighboring states in particular?
Well, one of the things that's unusual about Wisconsin's policy is what, as I mentioned, you can only have it the decision on your eligibility made at sentencing. In other states, you typically will complete your sentence and then go back and petition for expungement, which gives the judge a better sense of where that you've progressed and you are worthy of or deserving of getting your record cleared. So that's one big difference. Another thing in other states, you can petition for expungement no matter what age you were at the time the crime was committed. An unusual thing here in Wisconsin is you had to be under the age of 25 at the time you committed the crime to be able to petition for expungement or request expungement. So that's another unusual thing. There are a couple other things as well. A non-conviction, so the case ends in an acquittal or dismissed charge. In Wisconsin, there's no provision allowing people to expunge those records, where in other states that is possible.
How many people have successfully gotten their a criminal record expunged in Wisconsin in recent years?
The Badger Institute, a different research institute, did some research on this recently and found that about 2,000 cases are expunged per year in Wisconsin. So that's just an estimate.
And in your report, you look at a bunch of different options, different possible changes to the expungement process here in the state. What are a few of the things that you're looking at, and what kind of difference would they make?
Yeah, so we looked based on what we saw as differences with other states. So that was a big part of our analysis, was comparing how we're different. And then the options were things like changing, allowing people to petition after they've completed a sentence for expungement, or allowing them to petition for expungement of cases that occurred in the past. Currently, that's not allowed. A change like that would have a really large impact potentially on the volume of cases that could be eligible, because people could go back for things that have happened over a number of years and try to get those sealed. So that would have potentially, we looked at Milwaukee County as the largest county and where the most cases are handled, and that we found that could have thousands of cases could become eligible if a change like that were made. We also looked at removing the age requirement and allowing people of any age to petition for expungement. That would also have a large impact. We looked in Milwaukee County, it would probably be hundreds of cases each year that could become eligible.
Talking to Joe Pietrangelo. We're talking to Joe Pietrangelo, senior researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. A new report from the group looks at the way criminal records can be expunged, taken off the public record for people in various circumstances. Joe, let's talk about the economic impact of this now and how this could affect people looking for jobs.
Yeah, so that the angle we came to this issue from was for workforce development. We've done other research in the past on barriers to employment and found that criminal backgrounds were a very common barrier among Milwaukee area job seekers. So that's where we were coming from with this. We can't really give you numbers in terms of how many people could get back into the workforce exactly across the state, but based on some of the different changes we're looking at, we did find a large number of cases for a lot of these changes that could be eligible, and that could really eliminate a common barrier among Wisconsin's workforce. And when we're at a time when unemployment is down to around 3%, and an estimated 1.4 million individuals in Wisconsin have criminal records, this could make a significant difference.
I've seen some reaction from open records advocates saying, yes, it's too bad about the economic impact here, but there are cases where the public has a right to know if someone's involved, say, in a future crime, if they run for office later in life, something like that. The public should have access to this kind of information about people.
Yeah, and really that is a really good policy question that has to be debated. There are different interests in this kind of situation, public information access versus the privacy of individuals and the potential for people to move on from past offenses. So that is a tension in this kind of issue as the policymakers are considering possible changes.
One possible option you suggest in your report that sounded interesting was the idea of, and I think some states do this, a certificate of rehabilitation. So not necessarily taking something out of the records, but something that someone who has been charged and convicted of a crime can show to a potential employer. How would that work?
Yeah, so we found over a dozen states that have these types of certificates. So typically people would petition for a certificate after a certain period, like a waiting period after completing a sentence, and then they would go into the court and basically present their case, and then if the court deems them rehabilitated, they get this certificate which they can use. So then if employers are seeing records online, which is how a lot of employers are finding the records online, they can complement their application with this kind of certificate, and that can be helpful as well.
State lawmakers have been responding to your report today, and we see this afternoon State Representatives Evan Goyke and David Steffen announced that they will reintroduce expungement reform legislation. What are your thoughts on that and your hopes for potential changes?
Yeah, well, we had seen that there were bills in 2017, both in the Assembly and the Senate, that passed with overwhelming bipartisan support, but there were differences on the two sides that weren't resolved, and so there wasn't any change in that at that time. But certainly, moving forward, there will be additional proposals, and we'll see what happens with it in 2019.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Joe Pietrangelo, senior researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joined us to talk about a recent report looking at how the state's criminal records laws could keep people out of jobs. First, our next guest has called parenting an endless series of life hacks in order to stay one or two short steps ahead of your kids. He's talked about hiding vitamins in ketchup, making cough syrup ice pops, and developing his own tool belt of weird stain removal tactics. But as the father of two sons, he says the Me Too era is raising a lot of serious questions about how to raise boys to be good men. David McGlynn is a professor and chair in the English department at Lawrence University in Appleton. His latest book is called One Day You'll Thank Me: Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood. His piece in the New York Times is called In the Me Too Era, Raising Boys to Be Good Guys. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, obviously, writing this memoir, you've been thinking about parenting a lot and parenting your sons a lot. As the Me Too movement broke, all these stories about harassment and other sexual misbehavior came out. What was going through your head as a father of boys?
You know, that's a great question, because I was thinking about it from two different fronts. On one hand, you know, I was thinking, how do I, sort of teach my boys to respond to what is obviously a sort of grave series of injustices that are being committed? But also, how do I keep them out of trouble? It was obvious to me as I watched that movement unfold, and as I have watched it continue to unfold, that part of what's causing it are some of the assumptions and sort of kind of cultural attitudes about what it means to be male and masculine. And I wanted to help the boys sort of think about what things they might be able to do to, you know, both kind of foresee a better world and sort of work toward a better world, but also to avoid getting into trouble themselves.
Did you have the mental energy to do this? Because parenting, a lot of it is dealing with the day-to-day stuff, getting them to school, dealing with when they get sick, that sort of thing. Were you able to find time to navigate that big picture, am I raising good people concern?
Well, you know, I think that for most parents, right, we're always thinking about that in the backs of our minds, right? And you're right, right? Like, most of parenting is day-to-day. You know, we're sort of always having to respond to whatever target is coming after us, right? It's like we're sort of standing in front of an automated ball machine, like on a tennis court or something. You're just having to kind of hit back what comes at you. But nevertheless, I think probably every parent feels this way, that you're always trying to assess, am I doing the right thing? Am I helping these little people grow up to be good big people? And so in a way, whether or not I had the energy in the moment, I found myself thinking, I really need to pay attention to all this one way or another. And because I work in a college, I feel like I am in some ways sort of on the front lines of that conversation. My students, who are, you know, just coming out of their adolescence and into adulthood, are talking about it all the time. And so I couldn't not pay attention to it.
As you write in your New York Times piece, you looked around you for some expertise, both at Lawrence University and beyond. Who did you seek out to try to get some advice on raising boys to be good men?
Well, you know, that's actually a really great question. You know, the very first thing that I thought of as I sat down to sort of muse on that article was most of what I can accomplish is just, you know, I can accomplish everything I need to do just by talking seriously with my sons. And then I realized really quickly that wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to just have a series of conversations, even though that's the main thing we need to do. I needed to think more pragmatically. And so the first person I talked to, ironically, is a colleague at Lawrence. His name is Peter Gleck. He's in the psychology department, and his research focuses on bias, specifically gender bias. And he helped point the way to both, you know, some research and to some other people. And those other experts, one's a sociologist in Maine at Bates College, another woman is a psychologist at the University of Kentucky. They helped me to understand the ways that middle school and even elementary school kids are under a lot of pressure when it comes to the sort of cultural politics of sexuality. And that means that girls are often finding themselves sort of tacitly receiving sexual harassment even at a young age, and boys are often dispensing it. And it's not always a binary between boys and girls, but it's often that way. And a lot of that has to do with the pressures they feel not to be sexual, but rather to sort of fit into these attitudes and norms about what it means to be either a girl or a boy. And I found that, you know, really quite interesting. And one of the things that I didn't want to do was just list a bunch of things that boys shouldn't do, you know, things that they need to be punished for, because I felt like that's a probably surefire way to get boys to turn away, especially my sons, you know, who are sort of often kind of looking for ways to thwart me and, you know, upend my authority. That would be a surefire way for them to go in the opposite direction. And these people, these experts that I talked to, these psychologists and sociologists, said, no, you know, there's ways to think about it a lot more pragmatically, you know. And one suggested, for example, that, you know, if you watch a movie, get your kids to take note of how many men and women are in the movie, a very simple activity, and then to have a conversation over dinner about in what ways those men and women interact with each other and what roles they play in the movie. And that seems like an easy enough thing to do. Another woman, the sociologist in Maine, said, you know, one thing that could help would be to teach boys to maybe do a few jobs that are often reserved for girls, like doing the laundry and even mending clothes and that sort of thing. And she pointed out in a way that I thought was very interesting that, you know, girls are often taught that they can do anything a boy can do. But it's rare for a boy to be taught that they should also do the things that girls traditionally do, such as domestic household duties and being allowed to express themselves artistically or emotionally or what have you, you know. And by encouraging some of those perhaps non-traditionally masculine activities, boys can start to learn to be a bit more empathetic and considering of other points of view besides their own.
Talking to David McGlynn from Lawrence University in Appleton. His latest book is One Day You'll Thank Me, Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood. Talking about his piece in the New York Times called In the Me Too Era, Raising Boys to Be Good Guys. David, especially with middle school, I think there's almost this gender policing that boys do for each other. Maybe parents do it for them, where they're learning how to be boys, how to be men, and that role is really narrowed. When you talk to experts, when you thought about this, what are ways to help, I guess, prepare boys for that?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. In middle school, and especially because my older son is now coming to the end of middle school, is just a pressure cooker for these kinds of gender roles and gender expectations. I think in large part because, you know, you have this crash of biology, right? Their bodies are becoming so hormonal and they're going through puberty at such a rapid rate. And they're also, you know, because of puberty and because of their growth, getting large enough to do the things that they have for such a long period of time only been able to observe, right? So they're able to stay out for some period of time on their own, or they're able to go hunting with the parent or do other things with the parent. And that often, you know, those are all good things, but they can sometimes lead, you know, young men and young women to sort of slot themselves into these sort of narrow gender categories. And the experts I talked to said simply, you know, see if you can find ways to invert those things, you know. And so activities in which boys and girls can spend time together that are not competitive and are not sexualized, you know. And you know, I don't think that any parent would think that their junior high kids need to be doing sexualized activities. But you can nevertheless think about things other than just sort of parties and dances that might allow boys and girls to spend time together in ways that encourage them to think about each other as human beings, right? You know, and one example that was given to me and that we have since implemented is volunteering. And I thought that was a really nice thing. And my wife and my older son, who's now, you know, the sort of middle schooler, volunteer at the homeless shelter and the soup kitchen in Appleton. And simply by going once every couple weeks to feed people who are needy, my son has been able to observe the sort of needs of others. He also has observed both men and women in roles that are different from what he ordinarily sees. And I mean, you know, sort of being the chefs and the cooks and the servers. And they've been really positive role models for him.
One thing that people often teach as a positive for boys is the idea of chivalry and respect and protection of women. And at least one of the experts you talked to said, that's maybe not the right road. What was the case there?
Yeah, you know, that's a really great question. And I will confess that that was the one that took me the longest to get my head around, you know. And growing up, you know, my mother was always very firm with me that, you know, if I'm on a bus and the seats are taken and a woman gets on, I should stand up and give my seat up, and I should hold open the door, and I should hold open the car door, and et cetera. But it was Peter Glick, my colleague at Lawrence, who kind of talked me through that. And it's not so much that respectability and courtesy are wrong. In fact, those things are very good, right? We ought to give up our seats for people. We ought to hold open the doors for people. It's when it gets translated into the idea that women are inherently weaker and are in need of the protection of men, And so a man by being chivalrous, or a young man by being chivalrous, is sort of coming to the aid of the damsel in distress, that you have what Peter calls benevolent sexism. And other researchers call this benevolent sexism, which is a way of demeaning women just by simply thinking that they are, you know, you are well-intentioned, but you're taking care of someone who is by nature weaker. And it turns out that that is correlated to hostile sexism, in which people will demean and harass and, you know, et cetera, people of, you know, women, but also people who don't identify along the traditional sort of male-female binary. And that was a little hard for me to understand at first, but as he talked me through it and as I began to understand it, it began to make a lot more sense. And I think the way to think about it is, you know, we're trying to teach boys, I'm trying to teach my boys, to be empathetic towards every single human being that they meet ever. And that means if they are walking into a door and there are people coming in behind them, regardless of whether that person is a man or a woman or straight or LGBT, they ought to stop and hold the door open and let the other people go in first, simply because it's polite and one would want someone else to do that for them.
Briefly, David, just a few moments left. It's one thing to have this mental game plan. Is it easy to sit down with a couple teenage boys and have these conversations?
Well, you know, you try to have them one little bit at a time. You know, and the sociologist from Maine that I talked to said these kinds of conversations take place all the time. They take place on the way to swimming practice. They take place while you're doing the dishes. They take place while you're getting the lawnmower ready to cut the grass. They take place wherever and whenever you can. And the important thing is you just keep talking to each other and you keep trying to help your kids sort of confront the complexities of the world they live in and to become better people.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's David McGlynn, professor and chair in the English department at Lawrence University in Appleton. His latest book is One Day You'll Thank Me, Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood. And talking about his piece in the New York Times, In the Me Too Era, Raising Boys to Be Good Guys. There's a big-time shortage of truck drivers in the United States, with companies like Amazon and Walmart shipping more and more stuff across the country. About 51,000 additional drivers are needed, according to the American Trucking Associations. Because of the shortage, some deliveries are being delayed, and things we buy may start to cost more, and trade groups say the problem is going to get worse. The U.S. has been facing a driver shortage for years. It seems particularly bad right now, so what's going on? Heather Long is the economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, help us understand the scope of this driver shortage problem. How short are we? How big a deal is it?
Well, it's a huge deal, and you hit the nail on the head. It's probably going to end up costing all of us more because various companies, whether it's an Amazon or a Walmart, or whether it's a company like a Black & Decker or a General Mills with the cereals, you know, they're struggling to get their products on trucks. There just aren't enough of them right now in the U.S., and so it costs more to move those goods. Prices are shooting up, and they're passing those. You know, they're not going to be benevolent people who just accept that profit hit. They're going to pass those costs on to you, me, and all of your listeners.
Is the problem here that fewer people are going into trucking, or maybe more are leaving trucking, or that there's so much more demand, even with a stable supply of truckers, it's not keeping up?
It's a combination of both of those things. So the average age in the trucking industry is getting older. It's around 50 now, so not as many young people are coming into the business as before. The other big critical thing is pay isn't always great in the industry, particularly when you start out. You usually start out around $40,000 a year for your first year or two, and once you build up a good, clean driving record in the trucking industry, then you can start to command really high salaries. Some people I spoke with, you know, are making more like $80,000 to $100,000, but, you know, it takes a while to get there. It's a long haul, pun intended. And the third thing that's different this particular year is we've got, obviously, a really strong economy, so that means more stuff we want to put on trucks. We've got the Amazon effect, more people people ordering stuff online. That's got to go on trucks. And the third thing that's different this year is in December, the government implemented an electronic logging device for trucking. And that means no trucker can drive more than 11 hours straight. Then they have to take a 10-hour break. Now, that's a good thing. We don't want truckers driving 24 hours a day. That's not safe when they're if they fall asleep behind the wheel. But that means you can't just call up a driver and say, hey, drive a couple more hours for me tonight to get those goods delivered.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent at the Washington Post reporting on a shortage of truckers in the United States. Heather, you did call up a handful of truckers, a bunch of them around the country, just to get their take on what the job was like, the pros and definitely the cons. What kind of things did you hear from people?
Well, as you might imagine, I heard a lot from a lot of the truckers saying, look, this is a tough job, and only half of them would recommend it to their friends or family. Several of them said, no way do I want my son or my daughter involved in this industry. And the reason is, you know, you spend a lot of time on your own going around the country, and that sounds romantic. Oh, I get to see America. But, you know, that means you don't get to see family and friends for weeks, sometimes months at a time, particularly in the early years when you're kind of at the mercy of companies and they can send you anywhere. So I've had a lot of people tell me their relationships broke up. They blame their divorces on trucking because they're just never home. They miss a lot of their kids growing up, kids' events. So that's tough. Also, it's physically draining. A lot of truckers complain, you know, when you're sitting there for 11 hours a day in that truck compartment, you know, you sometimes get back problems. You're not exercising a lot. One female truck driver told me she gained 60 pounds the first year. So we're talking about a tough job. And in the early years, you're not going to get paid a whole lot.
Yeah, we heard from Jacqueline on Facebook who writes, I'm a truck driver, 14-hour days for $15 an hour, sleeping and living in a space smaller than most bathrooms for weeks on end, lousy food, no parking space at the end of the day, low pay, no idle laws that make you sleep in a hot truck with no air conditioning. Yep, great job. She's doing it, but not loving it. Is that the kind of thing you heard from other drivers?
Definitely. She summed it up perfectly, I think. I will say the half of the drivers who did recommend the job, and one of them I think we're going to talk to later, who's from Wisconsin, Daniel, they said, look, it's not the perfect job. It's not for everyone. But it is still one of the best jobs you can get with no college education, so only a high school degree. And then to become a long-haul trucker, you need something called a CDL, a commercial driving license. And you can get that with a 5-week course in the United States. So it doesn't take a lot of training to become a truck driver.
We also heard from Tom on Facebook who writes, haven't we been told that this is one of those jobs that will be done by computers? Can you blame workers for looking elsewhere? And yeah, Heather, we hear about efforts to create these self-driving trucks. That's not right on the horizon yet, but is that impacting the job market?
I think it's a really, really good point, and I discuss this with a lot of people in the trucking industry. Here's what most people in trucking will tell you. Yes, they're coming. Yes, it's having an impact on hiring. That's one of the reasons some younger people don't want to get into it. However, almost nobody thinks that we're going to have self-driving trucks on the road in the United States in the next 10 to 15 years. We have to get self-driving cars right first, and everybody who's been reading the headlines knows there's been incidences with those. And think about it, it's even more complicated to do a self-driving truck. It's a lot heavier, it's a lot bigger. You have to get, you know, it could kill a lot more people if something goes wrong. So that's still pretty far off.
I want to get more into the economic impact of all of this. You mentioned that, you know, if trucks aren't getting goods to places, costs are going up for shipping. If you pay drivers more to ship stuff, well, that's going to drive the cost of goods up. It could, at least some of the experts you talk to, actually drive inflation here in the United States. It could be that big a deal.
Yeah, it could definitely be that big a deal, particularly this spring. We saw both freight costs go up because we have this truck driving shortage, and we saw fuel prices go up. So you put that together, and that's a lot of expense that's going on in that industry. Walmart, in their recent earnings call, called it their primary headwind. This is their primary problem that they're dealing with right now, is this rising freight cost. And they were one of many companies companies that were talking about this. So yeah, I think there could be a real potential economic impact. I've been joking to my friends, only half joking, that if you plan to buy some holiday gifts for Christmas or Hanukkah, I'd buy them now, because if you think there's a shipping problem now, wait till October, November, December.
Talking to Heather Long about America's massive truck driver shortage. She's an economics correspondent for the Washington Post. According to the American Trucking Associations, there would need to be 51,000 extra drivers to meet demand as companies ship more and more goods across the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now, or have you ever been, a truck driver yourself? What do you like? What do you dislike about the job? Would you recommend it to someone else? Do you have questions for our guest about her reporting on this? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Also, if you are in a business that involves paying people to drive stuff for you, are you feeling this impact? Having a harder time getting space? Having a harder time paying for it? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation and talk to one of the Wisconsin drivers that Heather talked to for her piece. That's coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about America's truck driver shortage. It's causing deliveries to be delayed and could make things cost more for consumers. Trade groups say it's going to get worse. Heather Long is with us, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences as a driver. Is it a job you would recommend if you've done it? Have you thought about going into truck driving? Are you getting that CDL right now? If you own a business, is this affecting you? Call 800-642-1234. We have Dan Golnick on the line with us, a driver from Melrose near La Crosse. And Dan was featured in Heather's story about the shortage of drivers in the United States. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
So what do you like about driving?
Honestly, a lot of it's the independence you get from it. This is one of the very few jobs you can do where if you do a long haul, you can spend 2 or 3 days. You don't have a boss looking over your shoulder. You get to see the country on somebody else's dime. I've driven 47 of the 48 lower states, and I didn't have to pay to see any of it.
And you've done long haul, and I understand now you're doing a different route, and you're able to be home every night and weekends. Is that right? And is that a nice change of pace for you?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm doing a local LTL or less than truckload hauling right now. I'm home every single night and have weekends off. It's a very nice change of pace. It's a lot slowed down from a over-the-road lifestyle. You get to kind of enjoy your time and your money you make more.
And what are some of the biggest challenges or downsides you've seen?
To trucking in general, it's honestly probably the loneliness and the fact that a lot of companies, trucking companies and customers, don't seem to treat drivers like they're humans anymore. A lot of us are told, you know, we cannot use customer bathrooms, we can't park there overnight, even if our clock is out of time. Or, you know, they have us sit in a dock for 5 hours when it's 100 degrees and tell us we can't run our air conditioning and have our motors running.
So, Dan, that said, do you recommend this job to other people?
I do. It's not for everybody. You need to be able to deal with yourself fairly well. But it's a good job. It pays fairly decent for no college education. I actually have recommended it to a few of my friends. They've taken it up and said that it's a fairly good job for them.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, Heather, we heard Dan there, and you'd talk to him for your piece. It's a good job for the right people, he says.
Yep, I think he sums up the pros and cons beautifully. He did that in our piece as well. I think, to pick up, he kind of got lucky. He's a good example of somebody who started by driving all across the country doing this really tough be away from friends and family for weeks, if not months at a time. And now he's sort of hit the jackpot in the sense of he has a job now where he's home every night, which is pretty rare in the trucking industry. But you know, if we could just find a way to do that more and more for people. The other thing I hear a lot that he you know, he picked up on is a lot of people talk to me in the trucking business. They're frustrated that the logistics side of a lot of these Walmarts and Targets and other big companies just hasn't been figured out, and they end up what they call wasting a lot of time just sitting waiting for their trucks to get unloaded or loaded. So not only do we not have enough truckers, but we seem not to have enough people loading and unloading the trucks too.
Let's go to our callers now. We have Sarah on the line in Blue Mounds. Sarah, hi.
Hi. My question is whether or not addressing the safety concerns for women would maybe do a lot to ease the trucker shortage.
Is this something that, have you been a driver or thought about it yourself, Sarah?
I have thought about it in the past, but decided not to.
Because of concerns?
Yeah, safety concerns, yeah.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Heather, is the industry reaching out to women? Is this a common worry about safety, harassment, and other concerns for women in particular?
It's a great, great point that the caller made. You know, statistics, again, are hard to track, but most people say it's well under 10% are women in this industry. It's heavily male-dominated. There are safety concerns when you're alone, particularly at various, you know, various truck stops where over the years have been, I come from Pennsylvania in a big trucking area, you know, and there were reports over the years of human trafficking, of prostitution, of a lot of issues going on at truck stops. I'm not saying everybody, but, you know, there are some issues like that. Another concern when I talked to female truck drivers, I mentioned had featured one in my story, she told me, you know, you get treated like you're really dumb. You know, not only are you a truck driver and there's a perception from the general public that you're not well educated and that's why you're a truck driver, but within the industry, within your most of your almost all your bosses are male, almost all the people loading and unloading are male, and they treat you like you don't know what you're doing and sometimes ask you to do things that could be illegal or not right because they think you're not smart.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sarah. We'll go next to Ron with us in Whitewater. Ron, hi.
Hi. I started out driving a few years back over the road. I loved it. Then my son was born, and I was not going to be out on the road anymore. I came back, and the trucking industry kind of steps on their own feet, and that is most places that do local driving won't hire you unless you have 2 years' experience. Well, I didn't have 2 years' experience. And I believe that's because of insurance reasons. Larger companies that go over the road self-insure. And I was able to find a company local that does self-insure, and it's a concrete mixer that I drive now.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that story, Ron. Is this a common thing we've heard a couple times now, Heather? The over-the-road driver, maybe there's that change in their life, in particular with a new kid, and there's competition to get those local jobs that get you at home at night?
Yep, I think that's what I heard from numerous drivers, that the goal, the dream is to do the over the road driving all over the country for just a couple of years and then be able to transition to that job that's going to have you home at least on the weekends, if not in the evenings. The other possibility that some people who've been in the industry for, say, over a decade, what they'll sometimes do is become an independent contractor where they own their own truck. That's a big expense. It's hard to do, but they buy their own truck, and then they you know are basically self-employed running their own small trucking business, and that can sometimes be more lucrative for them.
Thanks for that call, Ron. We're talking to Heather Long from the Washington Post, looking at a shortage of truck drivers in the United States. Back to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Yeah. Another angle on this is, if I'm interpreting this correctly, is if people would shop in stores, we need fewer drivers, there'd be less pollution from all these big trucks, and there'd be less wear and tear on the roads.
Dennis, thanks for the call. So first of all, does it matter the truck has to get something to a store or to individuals? Does direct purchasing really mean more trucks, Heather?
It doesn't necessarily mean more trucks, but actually this is something that Daniel, who was just on the line, Daniel Golnick, the Wisconsin driver, stressed to me that he didn't say here, but I'll say for him, and that is he feels it means more delivery. So that probably is more use of gas, gotcha. More harm for the environment. So it's not that he's picking up more overall volume, but he's making a lot more starts and stops.
Gotcha. Okay, so it's not the one big stop at the one store. It's lots of little stops at different depots.
Yeah.
Got it. Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Peter on the line in Friendship. Peter, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking me on. I had I drove a truck for 14 years, and I was out of it. I'm out of it for 11 years. But the point I was trying to make is, one, it's a good life if you're single. If you're married, don't do it, because I lost my family because of it. Two, some of the truck companies that I dealt with, the equipment was so bad that I get pulled over by the DOT, and I was held responsible for fixing the crap. And the other thing is, when you go to a warehouse, the people in the warehouse, they treat you like you're dirt, you're trash. You can't do anything. And like another caller had made a point, is I spent 14 hours sitting waiting for a load that was supposed to have been there 8 hours ago.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. A lot of the negatives there, Heather, and you've heard, I think, all of those points from other drivers too.
Exactly, yeah. I would just add, he didn't talk about this, but I would just say that this point to stress on all this is, if we have such a crisis, we need so many more drivers, why isn't the pay going up? And that's really the big business and economic question. We're starting to see some dramatic rises. I did two stories on trucking, and the other one talked about a woman in Minnesota who owns a trucking company who's given a 15% raise to her drivers and expects to give another 10% raise by the end of the year, because there's so much poaching between companies right now, particularly of experienced drivers. But, you know, if the work is this hard, we need this many people, it's kind of weird that pay isn't rising.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Ralphie with us in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Hey, I wanted to say it's a kind of a different angle. I don't know if you really touched on this, but I was talking to a guy folks on my Craigslist, and we were chit-chatting. He was a trucker, and on the south side of Milwaukee, and he was saying that, you know, a lot of millennials, and this problem, mostly young men, there's a few women, but it's like anything else, like with the building trades or whatever. It's not like a lot of young guys are 18, graduate, and say, hey, this is what I want to do. I want to do this, let's say, semi-dirty job and go drive a truck. Maybe when their dads or their grandpas were in the Teamsters in the 70s, it was strong, and they see some of these negatives. You know, they all want to shop on Amazon on their app. But he was saying the big reason was, you know, let's say three guys are 21 years old and they're living.
I'm going to jump in, Ralphie, because we're just about out of time. But Heather, are millennials helping kill trucking, as people say they've killed so many other things?
Well, the statistics really point to they're not entering this field. And you could say it's low pay. You could say it's not a great job. But I think that caller hit it on the head. At the end of the day, millennials want to work in something that feels meaningful. And when they're being treated in a way that they're considered dumb or ignorant or lower class, who wants to do that? That's the, you know.
So the associations, trucking associations, as we wrap up, Heather, they're sounding the alarm here. Is there kind of an all-hands-on-deck effort to figure out how to bring more people into trucking?
Well, I'm actually flying Sunday to a trucking school in Ohio to answer that question. And I can tell you, I was speaking with a man who's 90 years old and is trying to go to the trucking school because there's so much demand. So, you know, in that sense, it's all hands on deck. But it sure seems like the easiest thing to do would be to raise those wages.
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Good conversation, Rob.
We've been talking to Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. We talked with her about America's truck driving shortage. She's been following this issue, talking to people in the industry, industry experts, and drivers themselves. You can follow her reporting at The Washington Post. And if you still have a story to tell, thanks for all your calls, by the way, you can still share your story. We've got a post up about this over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Are you a driver? Did you used to be? Have you thought about it? Are you on your way to becoming one? What are your thoughts on the job? The upsides, the downsides, if you've done it yourself, is this something you would recommend to others? Would you want your kids to go into the profession? Let us know over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I have a question. question for you. I want to hear your answer to it. What technology has become obsolete in your line of work in the last, say, 5, 10, 20 years? Email your answer to that question to ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Where's that coming from? Well, one of our technical people earlier today handed me what I've been using as my coaster during the show, a 3.5-inch floppy disk from a computer. I can't remember the last time I used one of those. He was handing them out. He's going to throw them away otherwise. And that got us talking about radio technology that we don't use anymore. Reel-to-reel tape. You know, it wound from one reel to the other, and you could edit it with a razor blade and little blue pieces of tape. I started just in time to learn how to do that. I'm glad I did. I'm glad I never have to do that anymore and could use computers. Also, carts, we call them, these weird cassette cartridges. They were loops, and you could record a few things on them. They had magnetic stops that you always hoped worked and played your audio right on the air. And that made me wonder, we've got a lot of these things in the radio world that, you know, they sit around here somewhere, but we don't use them anymore. What is there in your line of work that you used to use, but you don't anymore? Let us know by email at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.